All right, guys, welcome to the 7412. We're going to talk configuring advanced Windows Server 2012. Just wrapped up 4.11 and 4.10, another guy did earlier. I'm Brian Switergall. I'm a Microsoft Certified Trainer, and I'm going to be walking you through all this today. How many of you guys are actually taking all of the 4.10, 4.11, 4.12 on the exam front? Got a few hands up there. I see a few faces I recognize. And a bunch of new guys. Anybody just in here for 4.12? Didn't do any of the other ones? 4.11 too. All right, so like 4.11, we got a ton of content. There's going to be not quite as much in 4.11, so we'll be able to slow it down a little bit, maybe do a little more interaction, kind of see how it goes. Okay, so for those that sat through 4.11 and 4.10, you know, we have the intro to Microsoft certification, what it's all about, what kind of changes have been made in the last couple of years, specifically the last year. A little repetitive for some of you, but for some of you, it's going to be new. Let's first talk about the three levels. So we've got the associate level, the expert level, and then the master level. And you find the MCSA at the associate level. You find the MCSE at the expert level. That's what most people are looking to attain. And then for the highest level, the master cert. A lot of people will climb from MCSA to MCSE and continue on depending on what your goal is. And then MCSE is a little different today, right? If you go back a little while, you had MCSE, everyone's kind of the same, they know the same kind of stuff. We've got a bunch of different MCSEs now, and they're totally different technologies. You know, you got the private cloud, focused more on system center and integration, hybrid environments. And then you got the server infrastructure, which I call it the traditional MCSE, more AD and infrastructure related. And then you got the desktop side. You really haven't had an MCSE on the desktop side before, so that's a high-level desktop guy. There's a bunch of different paths that you can go down. The 4.12 today is one of the exams that gets you to your MCSA. So it's 4.10, 4.11, 4.12, you got your MCSA. We'll talk a little bit about that as we come up here. So if you already have a certification, specifically the stuff in the blue here, MCITP, EA, for instance, and some of the other ones, then you may want to bypass the 4.10, 4.11, 4.12, and just go straight to the 4.17. So for those that are doing that, this will give you good information for a portion of the 4.17, but it only represents the one portion. Maybe you feel good about the other ones, and some of you have been sitting in all three of them today, and so you would have enough to go take the 4.17, or go the other route and just do 1, 2, 3, right? All right, so one of the things I tell everyone is the website has all of the stuff we're going to talk about today. Not the information, but the high-level OD and topics. So if you go up there, bottom side, skills measured, there's a list of every single kind of high-level thing you're expected to know when you take the exam. We're going to walk through it. The way the PowerPoint's laid out is took them right off the website, have the high-level title slide, and we'll talk about all the bullets. Every single thing you're supposed to know, we're going to say something about. I'm going to give you one exam tidbit, one command, one tidbit that just will maybe get you through a question or a scenario, or maybe direct you to some extra studying or something like that. So we're going to talk about all of them. So what to know, what to expect, the anatomy of the question. If you guys haven't taken an exam in a long time, Microsoft-specific, you may not be familiar with how things are laid out or the item types. We're going to talk a little bit about that before we dive into the actual content. So all of them are the same sort of basic layout. They call it the item stem, and it introduces who you are. You're a sysadmin. You work for so-and-so. You got a certain set of technologies in place, or you want to put them in place. And you either have a problem or you have a goal you're trying to reach. Hey, you need to do this. You need to do that. You need to ascertain why this or why that. What should you do? And then you get your answer choices and you select one. But let's talk about how those might be shown to you instead of in the general question and answer multiple choice format, because there's a bunch of new formats. So this is a representation of most of the formats that are out there. The one that I kind of just gave you right now is the multiple choice, right? You might have a choose one, choose all that apply, choose all, choose two, something like that. But the ones you really want to know about are all the new ones. You know, we talk about build lists, best answer, active screen, hot area. A lot of you guys are probably looking at these terms and saying, hey, what do they mean? So all of this stuff is fully detailed out on the Microsoft site, Microsoft Learning site specifically, and then on the Born to Learn blog. So you get some blog posts about these item types. And in fact, there was a blog post recently about a new style of case study that they're thinking about doing. And you can run through the case study video and actually put your input in about it. And then they'll use that input to kind of finalize that particular item type. And then they'll bring it into the exam. That's how a lot of these got up there. But for some people, when you go into an exam, the last thing you want to be focused on is like the question type. How do I do this? Do I drag it into the right place? So I kind of tell people, go and check them out ahead of time. Get comfortable with them. You can actually run through some demo stuff on the site. And that way, you're just focused on the content and getting to the right answer. So these are the high-level objectives. We have six of them. They each represent about 15 to 20%, usually something like 17, 18%. So each of the sections, you got to kind of be pretty strong on. You can't, you don't have like a 60 or 70% on one of these and you just nail that down and you're good. You really need to know about all this stuff. We're going to dive into the details, all the exam tidbits in just a couple minutes. All right, before we dive into the actual content, anybody have any questions on the new certification program, the 412 specifically, or maybe MCSA, MCC, anything like that? Go ahead, in the front. So MCSC, so in fact, you can look at all the MCCs in a similar light. The MCSA plus typically two, what I'll call specialty exams. No, that would be your private cloud. Private cloud route is where you go more config man. All right, so we'll dive right in. One of the things I said in my earlier session is there's a pretty good amount of stuff to throw out here. So I'm going to have to fly through some of the slides. I'm not going to read everything verbatim, but I will talk about most of the stuff. And then the slide deck will be available next week. The audio is going to be available next week. So you guys are going to be able to, you don't have to write everything down. It's going to be pretty much there. But if there's something you want to write down, it's okay too. All right, so first topic, configure network load balancing. I got two slides on this. First things first, we've got to know how to install this thing, right? Install Windows feature, that's the PowerShell way. That's going to be the primary way you want to think about for everything we cover today. You've got to know how to do it in PowerShell, how to install it. And then you want to know the caveats, the prereqs. For NLB specifically, the node's got to be in the same subnet. So people thinking about, you got a branch office and a main office, probably not in the same subnet, probably not going to be an NLB candidate. Got to be configured for multicast or unicast, not both. So you want to be aware of what is multicast, what is unicast, right? One thing I mentioned earlier, server manager command deprecated. So I'll talk a little bit about this as we go through. There's a lot of tools that are new, and then there's a lot of tools that are still there, but they're deprecated. Typically, you're going to find that the exam covers the new stuff. So if you find old tools as your answer choice, I would consider that kind of a red, yellow flag. Look for something newer. Look for PowerShell. This is a good example here for Server Manager Command because you could do it with that too. So adding a host to a cluster. You put up an NLB cluster. How do you add a host? Get NLB cluster, get your cluster name, and then you pipe it to add NLB cluster mode. You don't really need to know a whole bunch more PowerShell than the basic stuff here. You know the commandlet name. You know how to pipe the output of the commandlet to another commandlet. That's about as far as it's going to go. If you can know the commandlet names, be familiar with the verb, noun syntax, that's going to be probably all you need to know for the exam. We'll dive into a bunch of these as we walk through some of the different technologies. On client affinity, this is a setting when you're doing NLB. Be familiar with none, single, and network, because this is definitely something that could be called out in an item or two. And you're going to want to know, you're going to get a series of requirements that, hey, I want all client computers to always do this. And then you want to kind of match that up, right? And then a little bit more network load balancing. You got to configure the port rules, multiple host, single host disabled. You want to know how to do it with PowerShell. Same thing. Add NLB cluster port rule. That's pretty straightforward. I think I said in my earlier session, the PowerShell stuff is, it reads like English. Add a port rule, add this, get that, set this. Be aware of it, though. And if you're not in PowerShell all the time, then spend a little bit of time in it before you go sit the exam. And then NLB cluster operation mode. I talked to unicast, multicast, or IGMP multicast. The default's unicast. throughout the whole exam, always know about the defaults. Always know, like, you know, what you have by default, what the limitations are, all these types of idiosyncrasies, because that's what's going to come up on a lot of the items. And then if multicast is enabled, the cluster IP has to be converted to multicast as well. These are little caveats that'll, you know, may come into play. Finally, on NLB, upgrading an NLB cluster, you want to know the whole process. I'm calling out, you know, a tidbit, but you want to kind of know the process at a high level. What's it take? What are the prereqs? What operating systems do you need to have? What if your NLB is on, you know, 2003? You want to know about that type of stuff. But on this one, I'm calling out, ensure the unicast interhost communication is enabled, and then watch for stuff like, hey, minimize downtime. That's when you do the drain stop, right? Wait for everyone to pop off, and then you can start the process. So that's going to be the type of stuff you want to look for. All right, so failover clustering. Talking about high availability. Talking about putting two nodes up. We're talking about a service or an application that can't have any downtime or has to have very little downtime. You want to know about the quorum models. These are new. If you haven't worked with it in 2008 or newer, you have the no majority, no witness. You really want to know when to use these. So odd node, even number of nodes. If you have like five nodes, you got to know which quorum model to use. And you want to know the pros and cons of each. So if you look at like no majority disk witness only, that's a single point of failure. But there could be a problem where, hey, that might be the best choice. It may not be a best practice, but we're talking about the best choice for a given scenario. If they lay out a scenario where it's got to be the fastest to set up and you've got to use this server and you have to have this, maybe that's the choice. So be wary of that. Don't look always for best practices. Look for whatever it is that solves the goal. That's it. On the cluster networking side, you know, you have two primary options to really think about on the networking. You know, do you want to allow the cluster only to communicate on the network, or do you also want to allow clients to communicate on the network? You know, do you want to dedicate the network? Do you want to share the network? This ties back to like, hey, how many network cards do you have? Are they virtual? Can you add more? Are you limited? What's the constraints? And when you find and look at the requirements, you want to kind of plug those in and figure out if you need the option or you don't. Anything on any questions on failover clustering from the exam perspective?
What questions on IPv6?
Don't expect to see any IPv6 on cluster, yeah.
What are the
storage requirements? So, you know, when you think about the exam topic, configure failover clusters, they could hit you with any of the prerequisites. Like OS level, you know, they may try to throw you with like data center version or standard version, you know, those kind of things. It's all going to be prereqs. So you want to be familiar with that. I wouldn't expect much on the storage specific, at least for this section. And now we get into a new session where we talk specifically about cluster storage. So a couple things. I think the first thing, if you were going to spend any amount of time on storage specific to failover clusters, you're going to want to spend some time on CSVs. How many people are using CSVs in their environment? Only a couple. So definitely expect some sort of something on CSVs specific to clustering. One of the big things with CSVs in 2012 is, you know, CSVs used to be Hyper-V only, 2008 R2, and now they've expanded them, scale-out file server and other uses for applications. So you want to be familiar with that because a lot of times you're going to look for, like, the new features and they're going to hit you on those new features, and you want to know the idiosyncrasies and all that kind of stuff. The big thing for CSVs, though, historically and still today, is you have one LAN, you put 10 VMs on it. You need to move one VM to the other node, and you don't want to impact any of the other VMs. What do you do? Or what do you do first? And first, well, you got to move them to a CSV first. But you're going to look for stuff like that because you're going to have those prereqs. You want to know what CSVs do, and you want to look at what the requirements are and really look carefully. Storage pools, this particular thing is covered, I think, in 4.10, and then from a cluster perspective, it's listed here, so don't think of it from a standalone perspective. This is new for clustering, is the storage pools. You want to know about the thin or thick provisioning of them, add more disks as needed, and then I put a sample commandlet down there for you. So another new one is the cluster-aware updating. So a lot of you guys probably have at least, you know, a cluster, or more, maybe a bunch of different clusters. You go to do your monthly patching, and everyone's got a technique. Maybe you patch up, you know, the inactive node and reboot it, and then you fail over, and then you patch the active. Cluster updating is really all about making that easier. And just knowing what it does and what its capabilities are key. You might get a scenario where it's like, hey, you need to minimize downtime, you need to do monthly patching, you have all these clusters, which technology should you use? Clusterware updating. It's probably not going to get too deep into this specific thing, but I list a few things. Updates itself on a schedule, and then you got remote updating mode, which is you can update from the coordinator machine. I would review this one time, know about what it does, it's probably going to be enough for you. All right, so manage the roles. What we're talking about here are when you have your failover cluster and you want a cluster like DHCP, file server, stuff like that, those are the built-in roles. So if you don't have a built-in role, but you want to, and I'll point you out to, I don't list them up here, maybe I list them in a slide or two. Well, actually they're on the top there. DFS namespace, DHCP, file server, virtual machine. If it's not one of those, then you drive down into the generic options. Generic application, script or service, you want to know what all three of those are and how they vary and what the differences are. In the parentheses really is what key to remember. Like, you know, the generic service is any Windows service. So if you have an application that runs as a service, that's the one. You might get caught up because, you know, you might see a scenario where it's an application but it doesn't run, or it's an application but it runs as a service. And they'll call it out like that. And you know, you gotta be careful because is it a generic app or is it a service? Always remember, if it runs as a service, it's a service. So. All right, so we're switching gears here. We're gonna talk manage virtual machine movement. So we're talking about live migration. And first let's talk about non-clustered virtual machines. What are the requirements to move a non-clustered virtual machine? Got to be in the same domain or with a domain trust. That's it. So when you see a scenario where it's a standalone box, not a domain, and you're thinking about, hey, you need to get this over to the other side as quick as possible for maintenance, it's not live migration. And you want to be able to call that out right away off the top of your head. Cluster virtual machines, got to make sure the network's configured for live migration. Troubleshooting scenario, you know, you're trying to live migrate the machine, you can't do it, what's going on, it's not enabled for live migration. And then the PowerShell, move cluster virtual machine role, name, node, target, one VM at a time. You might get a scenario where it's like, hey, we need to move 10 VMs over as fast as possible. What do you do? Well, do you do one at a time with live migration, or do you do a quick migration? You want to be able to differentiate between those. And then let's talk about quick migration. So you can move multiple VMs simultaneously. So that's key. Big thing though, right here at the bottom. Downtime likely to be noticeable. So if you have Hyper-V in your environment, or if you have access to a Hyper-V box or a home lab or something like that, I recommend what people do is they bring up their machine and bring up Notepad or a ping, constant ping, move a machine and watch what happens. You drop a ping, you drop Notepad, you drop an RDP session. Be familiar with that for, you know, the quick migration and the live migration. So that way you can go through the scenario and be able to answer to it. Because the requirements are going to be, you know, different and varied. We've got three slides on this. So you can also do a storage migration. Running low on disk space, you know, what can you do? What are your options? One of them is perform a storage migration. Got a new SAN, faster SAN. Want to move some of the storage over there, speed up your VMs, that kind of thing. Call out the PowerShell again, move VM storage, very straightforward. One thing I want to point out, highly unlikely that you're going to see like a commandlet like move VM storage and then have it duplicated and have one letter off or capitalization or something where you're kind of like, wait, is that a period or a dash? I'm not going to get, try to trick you like that. Knowing the commandlet name by itself goes a very long way. So import, export, copy VMs. I call it the import VM, the path, copy switch. The key here, generate new ID. That doesn't really, people read that and go, what does that mean, generate new ID? Well, that's to allow multiple imports of the same VM. Think about it like a template, a poor man's template, I call it, right? Because if you don't have System Center, that's your template. Export a VM, that's your gold image. You can import it multiple times. Got to use a generate new ID. Otherwise, you lost it, and you got to re-export it and all that kind of stuff. So that's probably the key thing there. With the export VM stuff, Very straightforward if you've never done it. You export it, right-click export. You can do the export VM. There's no options. You just choose where it goes. That's it. You're done. And then a final slide on the virtual machine movement. Migrate from other platforms. Make them up. So, you know, you got a virtual machine manager. I call out a few things here. You may or may not see any of this stuff on there. One thing I want to do point out, though, is the disk to VHD. So you don't have VMM, let's call it out. How, you know, what tool do you use? You'll often find questions on the exam is, what tool do you use? And it's simple. You don't have to know how to, you don't need to know the whole command a lot of times, but you've got to know the tools. What do they do? What are their constraints? What are the prerequisites? Disk to VHD, I tell a lot of people, run it one time. Before you go sit the exam, run it one time, do something with it. And that will go a long way. V2V from VMware. The only thing I want to point out there is uninstall the VMware tools. And that, I mean, you know, you go to TechNet and you talk about doing a V2V from VMware, and the first thing you see is a big box. Uninstall VMware tools. Because the Hyper-V version of the tools is going on, right? All right, so that brings us to our first example question. These things are, I just wrote them up based on, you know, the OD. So you're a system administrator for Contoso. You manage a Hyper-V failover cluster. All the VMs are stored on a single standard cluster disk. You need to move a single VM from one node to the other without impacting the other VMs. What should you do first? We've got an extra W. And we talked about this earlier already. I gave it away. So that's going to be perform a storage migration to the cluster shared volumes. And the key on these is when you're taking these exams, watch for those questions. What should you do first? And that's what you should do first. If it said what should you do, you would need to do this, and then you would need to actually move the VM to complete the whole thing. So you want to be aware of the nuances. All right, I guess before we move on, clustering, moving VMs, anybody want to talk for a minute on that? Any questions? All right, we'll keep moving. There's a ton of content. Configure file and storage solutions. We're talking mostly advanced file services, dynamic access control, that's going to be huge, and optimized storage. For those that have taken the 410, you'll see like file and storage solutions on 410, 411, 412, very similar stuff. It's all different. Every exam, it's a different topic. So if you felt like you passed 410, you're not ready for 412 yet. So advanced file services, let's first talk NFS. Knowing that, you know, you go between Windows and Unix, install NFS role, export some volumes. Continuous availability, VMware support now, that's kind of new. And then the add Windows feature, file server NFS services. And then that's the PowerShell commandlet to do an NFS share if you've got some Linux hosts out there. That's about all you really need to know with NFS. They're not going to dive deep into NFS. Helpful to know the basics, though. And then branch cache, hosted cache, and distributed cache. That's the only thing you need to know about branch cache is what are the differences and when might you use one over the other. You've got a branch office, you've got a file server. You want to improve performance over the WAN. Don't have a secure server facility, what should you do? Probably distributed cache mode with all the client computers. Got a server closet, some telephony gear in there, right? Maybe you want to throw a server in there. Maybe the way the work style, you might have some requirements for the work style. The guys are in and out of the office all the time. The cache never builds up or, you know, it's not right. So you want to know the difference between distributed and hosted cache. Also want to know that NetSH is a tool you use. You don't really need to memorize a command, but you want to know NetSH for sure. File classification. So this is basically a way to take all the, call it the unstructured data on your network and classify it. You know, maybe you got HR data. You know, right now a lot of people, they put like an HR folder and an accounting folder and a payroll folder, and that's your classification. This kind of goes a step farther. You know, you can say, hey, all these Excel spreadsheets are classified a certain way. Maybe you're under SOX or HIPAA or something else. This is where file classification comes in. And there's really three methods, manual, location, and content-based. You want to know the difference between those. They're pretty straightforward. You know, the manual way, you right-click the properties of the file, and you can go to the classification tab if you guys never saw it, and then you can just configure it manually. That's obviously high overhead. But you can use Windows PowerShell scripts and automate it. And then the content-based and location-based, if it's in a certain folder or you want to put some more rules around it. Be aware of what it is, though, and what the limitations are. And then hand in hand with that is like the auditing. How do you audit who's coming through? What's new is the expression-based auditing. So with the dynamic access control, we're going to talk about that in just a couple minutes. One of the things you can do with the expression-based auditing is like, hey, if you're a member of a group and you try to go here and it's this kind of file and it's this kind of day, then do this. That's kind of the expression-based auditing. Maybe log an event in the event log. All right, so let's talk about DAC, Dynamic Access Control. The first thing I'll point out about DAC, a lot of people don't have it deployed yet. A lot of people have never seen it. And if I were to tell you to study one area, this would be the area I'd tell you. This is key. I wouldn't take the exam unless you have a pretty good feel for it. You don't necessarily have to have it in production, but you've got to touch it. Go through the configuration process one time, kind of see the order of things. It's big. So let's walk through some of this stuff. So configure user and device claim types. You want to know that a user claim is associated with a user, user attributes, pretty straightforward. Resource attributes or properties for use and authorization, like, hey, you're from a certain city, country, you got a certain extension attribute configured, right? And then event 4626 security log monitors user and device claims. So it may come up in a troubleshooting question or something. And then policy changes and staging. So this allows you to kind of stage everything. If you ever use like the advanced group policy stuff where you can kind of stage and test stuff ahead of time, it's kind of similar. And when you stage policies, you don't get grant or deny. It's just audit. So a lot of times people do that at the beginning and kind of see what they're going to work with, and then they'll go through and configure it for production. So the caveat here, Windows 8 and 2012 must use DCs that run 2012 or the authentication will fail. Certainly could come up in a scenario, so be aware of that. One more on DAC. So access denied remediation. This is kind of a cool thing. A lot of stuff in IT is going to the self-service stuff, right? Self-service password reset, self-service group management, all that. Self-service, hey, give me access to the files. That's kind of what this is. Users can request access from the data owner. Knowing even who owns the data is like a big, huge step, right? So that's part of the process. And then you can send out an email to the data owner or so-and-so. It's sort of like, for those that know SharePoint, you know, you get to like a site and you can't get access, request access. It's very similar. But just knowing what that is, access denied remediation, is going to go a long way. And then the file server admin can view the affected permissions to troubleshoot. I lay out a commandlet. No need to memorize that or anything, but just there for reference. Anything on dynamic access control? I mean, it's a big topic. One thing I want to remind everyone, I'm just calling out one or two tidbits on some of the high-level topics. There's more to know. Go through it and touch it, and but if you want me to cover something, I can real quick. All right. Configure and optimize storage. This is another one of the primary areas. First thing we're going to talk about is iSCSI. So you got your target, you got your initiator, and you can do a target server as a failover cluster role now. The one thing to know about that, disks are offline by default in a failover cluster. So troubleshooting scenario. I think I've seen forum posts about this. You know, hey, I can't get the thing going. What's going on? Well, it's offline, disk offline. So it's just something to know. And then how do you add the feature, the iSCSI target server right there and the portal right there. Let's jump into the ISNS. So you got a lot of iSCSI, big network, becomes unmanageable. So think about a scenario where it's like, hey, you want to minimize administrative overhead. You got tons of iSCSI out there. What technology could you tap to minimize my administrative overhead? That's this one, ISNS. Automates the discovery configuration management of iSCSI. Only supports iSCSI. And it's basically a database of all the iSCSI nodes for the most part. And then one last thing, the discovery domains provide zoning functionality for those that are doing a little bit more storage, if you know what zoning is. I think that I call that easing administration because I try to tie like a lot of these topics to what it is. It's better security, easing administration, more efficient work, whatever, and that helps on the exam sometimes. So thin provisioning and trim. Anybody actually using thin provisioning outside of Microsoft? Like, you know, like in NetApp or EMC? So So a good chunk of you. I mean, now it's coming into, you know, the server world, basically on the Microsoft side. And, you know, you have thin provisioning, trim, and dedupe. Specifically for this exam, it's really thin provisioning and trim. I mean, you want to know about the different forecasting methods. And then you want to know about the temporary and the permanent exhaustion setting. So partition goes offline, that's obviously a big deal. There's likely a scenario laid out where it's like, hey, you don't want anything to ever go offline. And that would be your first one, the temporary resource exhaustion, right? You want to know those settings when you walk in. And then free space, features on demand. So, you know, back in the old days, you put the i386 folder on a server so you could always install stuff without getting the disk. And now everything's really on there, so you can install features and roles like without having the disk. And now what I'm talking about here is taking all of those off to save disk space. It's called out in the OD. I call it out here. I don't think it's a big deal. But it's good to know that you can actually uninstall the binaries off the server. And thus, when you go to install a role where the binaries are removed, you got to point it to a source, or you got to add the binaries back in. It's a little tidbit. It's called out in the OD, so here it is. All right, so example question. You're the system administrator for Contoso. You have a main office and a branch office. Single file server at the main office. Branch office does not have a secure facility. High latency connection. You need to improve the performance when they access documents. What should you do? And from our discussion earlier, we should do the distribution cache mod. Distributed, it should actually say distributed cache mod. The key there, of course, is we don't have room for a server. All right, so now we're on a new functional group, implement business continuity and disaster recovery. This is going to be a lot of backups, recovery, and then site-level fault tolerance stuff. So first things first on the backups. How do you install the backup feature? It's the same thing we've been talking about, install Windows feature. If you want to do a scheduled backup, wbadmin enable backup, wbadmin start backup for one-time backup. I talked about this in my 411 class. And you really need to know the wbadmin stuff because it's going to be like, hey, you need to take a one-time backup. Hey, you need to do a scheduled backup. You've got to know what the command is. And the big one here, a lot of people probably haven't used this, is the Windows Online Backups, Azure Backups, names changing from time to time. I actually put these in place, and you know you can use the GUI to backup right to Azure. You want to know about that? They have a free trial, so you can go sign up, and within about maybe 30 minutes, you can have Azure Backups from any server, and it's free, and you can try it out, and probably take you 30 minutes. I'd recommend doing that because there's a couple things that come out of that, and I think I call them out here. So download the agent and register the server. If I was going to tell you anything on this slide, that would be the one. Because often it's like, download the agent. I already have Windows Backup. What am I downloading, right? But if you go through it, then you know that. And those are the types of things that might be tested. And then configure manage backups. Last thing, VSS setting using VSS admin. You want to know what VSS admin does. Run it a couple times from, you know, like your file server, if you have it enabled. It'll display your shadow copy backups, all the properties. And if you want to create a shadow for a specific volume, you can run that command. This is specifically called out as part of one of the ODs, right? So when you see a command like VSS admin as part of the OD, you've got to spend some time with it. Before we move forward, anybody want to go further in any of that? All right. Site-level fault tolerance. Specifically, we're talking about, first, is Hyper-V replicas. So when you think about the 410, you talk about Hyper-V, how to set up a VM, a single node, that kind of thing. 411, you start getting into some more advanced stuff. And this is the one where you get into the replicas. So a replica is basically you take a VM from one host and you replicate it to another, and it can be started on the other host. There's specific requirements and specific ways it communicates, and you want to know everything I've listed here. You kind of want to know the situation we talked about, planned failover and unplanned failover. These are the perfect exam scenarios that somebody would write to. You got an outage coming up, data center shutdown, electricity's going off. You want to do a planned failover. What should you do? And you want to know about that process. no data loss is key on that particular one. Then you got the unplanned failover. You know, if somebody says, hey, we need to do a failover with no data loss, well, you can see right away that the unplanned one would not be, you know, possible. You want to know those caveats. All right, so configuring multi-site clustering, using failover clustering with the quorum, even number of nodes. I talked about this in the 4.11 stuff. For those that didn't get a chance to sit in that, you know, the deck will be available with the audio. So I tell a lot of people, 4.11, 4.12 kind of go hand in hand. You'll probably go 4.11 then 4.12. Look at the content from both, because you might get little pieces from each one. They're both, you know, produced independently. So. And then you want to know some of the theoretical limits, 64 nodes, 8,000 virtual machines. It's probably not going to be tested on, but it's good to know. All right, so next example question. You are the network administrator for Tailspin Toys. You need to ensure that users can get to the previous versions of files on the file server. The files are stored in the D volume. What should you use? And this is a common scenario. What tool should you use? It's going to be on the test. Maybe not this particular tool, but just what tool should you use to do certain things? You're going to want to know the tools and what they do. Be able to call them out from this. You know, all these are valid tools, but they have nothing to do with the previous versions except the one. All right, we're going to dive into networking and a few new things like IPAM. First thing is the advanced DHCP. We're talking super scopes and multicast scopes. The one thing to know about super scopes is you got to know what a super scope is. That's going to be your basic thing. And you want to know the commandlet. Thing is nice about the PowerShell stuff is you can really pull the commandlet out of a list. If you see a list of tools and one of them is a commandlet and it says DHCP, it's probably the one. Because, you know, it's PowerShell, number one, and then it's laid out like, you know, noun, verb, so you can pick it out pretty quick. The multicast scopes, you want to know what multicast is, you know, send one stream to multiple computers. It's supposed to save bandwidth, WDS, multicast. Those are the, you know, typical uses. You just want to know what that is, what the difference between that and unicast. And then let's drop into DHCP v6. So you got really two choices. Acquire like DNS settings or other settings, non-IP, or acquire IP and DNS from DHCP for IPv6. You want to know what the difference is, stateless and stateful. Just know the definitions. That's all you're going to need. And then finally, how to add IPv6 DHCP scope. So high availability for DHCP. That's been around for a long time. The one thing to know, it's one of the failover cluster roles we talked about earlier. So you can tap into that. You do the split scope DHCP. You can only do two servers. So you might get a scenario where it's like, hey, you need high availability DHCP. You have four sites and four DHCP servers. What should you do? Make one cluster, make two clusters. You know, it's going to be stuff like that. So always know those caveats. And then IPv4 scopes and subnets only for the high availability stuff. Same scenario, right? It's got to be IPv6. You need it to be as highly available as possible. What do you do? Well, it's not a failover cluster. So knowing all this stuff is going to be key. And then DHCP name protection. This one is, it prevents name squatting. So, you know, if you have a Windows computer and it does dynamic registration via DHCP, in general, it's not going to do duplicates. But if you have a different host, like a Linux box, you can get into those scenarios. This is what prevents that. So if it's in use by a Windows host and a non-Windows guy comes along, the DHCP name protection will be your answer. Maybe it's called out as DHCID. You see a DHCID resource record here. At least tie those two things together and know what they're for. All right, so let's jump into DNS. The DNS sec stuff, those are the security extensions, online signing, key management, only supported in Active Directory integrated DNS environments, zone signing, signs each individual record, and then you can re-sign. The main thing with the DNS sec is knowing the limitations and then when you might call it and use it as the technology of choice. It might be something, a security requirement of some sort, but you definitely want to check it out. And in fact, for those that have a lab environment, you know, it would take about 5 or 10 minutes to configure DNSSEC on its own, and you'd be good to go. I recommend touching all that stuff if you can. DNS logging, just pretty basic stuff. You want to know about the DNS server log. You want to know about the counters, you know, perfmon counters, if you want to see how many queries are coming against the DNS server or something like that. I won't dive too much into that. And then the zone delegation, talked a little bit about this on the 411. You're adding subdomains, mergers, acquisitions. You got different admin teams, different parts of management of the zone. Divide really huge zones into smaller ones. Very specific scenarios. Maybe you want to minimize bandwidth or minimize replication, things like that. That's when you're going to think about zone delegation. All right, so implement an advanced DNS solution. So recursion. Who here can tell me what recursion is? DNS recursion. Right up here.
So you said your client sends a query to the DNS server then goes to another DNS server.
Yeah, so he said client, you configure a DNS server to go to another DNS server to get the answer. You know, client queries one, he may not know the answer. Recursion allows him to keep going and to find that answer. Go out all of the root hints, find out who's authoritative, come back with the answer. No recursion, obviously, is the opposite of that. But you want to know that type of stuff. And then DNS command. That's going to probably be something you want to know, too. So you can configure the server. You can do a bunch of stuff with DNS command. Add records. You want to know what your capabilities are there. So if you see that as a answer choice, you know, is it right or is it wrong? You want to know about that command. Netmask ordering. So based on where the query comes from, if it comes from the local segment, then you want to return a response based on where the query came from. That's kind of like, you know, these will come up in like efficient use scenarios, right? You got low bandwidth, you got multiple sites, you got DNS servers in different places. You want to just try to keep things orderly. Maybe you have a web server with all the same content in 4 different sites. Make sure the client goes to the one that's at his site. That's what we're talking about. Local subnet priority is on by default. So, and then the global name zone. This is something you want to research a little bit. This allows single name resolution, like I say, server 01. So, a lot of times people have their environment configured, so if you type in ping server 01, it will append your domain name to the end of it, and so it feels like you're getting single name resolution, but you're not really. Single name resolution, if you turned all that off, isn't going to work, and that's where the global name stuff comes in. Be familiar with it. I could see it coming out in a couple of questions. Doesn't rely on WINS, and it also has IPv6 support. So IP address management, otherwise known as IPAM. This is new, and you know there's a lot of third-party vendors. You know, I have a lot of customers that have a third-party solution here, Blue Cat, Infoblox, those are the big ones. Now you can put it as a roll-up on 2012, and it does not quite as much as the third-party stuff, but it does a lot for most people, takes care of their needs. The thing to know about is the different models, distributed, centralized, and the hybrid. And then know that the database is never shared. So these types of scenarios are going to come up. This is a, you know, this is a pretty big topic on the exam. So I'd spend ample time doing it. The one thing I want to point out here, you know, you have the IPAM administrators group. And so often people put the IPAM administrator in there, and then they go to try to manage DNS or DHCP and stuff. They don't get anywhere because they still have to have rights to wherever they're going to manage. Even though they're the IPAM administrator, they still got to have rights everywhere else. So be aware of that little caveat. And then server discovery must be joined, domain joined in a single AD4, cannot be on a DC. This is all still related to IPAM. Can't put IPAM on the DC, got to be domain joined, and got to have the forest. If you have a multi-forest environment, then you do multiple IPAMs, and again, database not shared. A little bit of a headache, nightmare. And then you don't get an external database. You get, maybe you can see a distractor like, hey, let's we want to maximize the availability of the data, put it on SQL. Can't do it. All right, brings us to our example question. This is the choose all that apply, everyone's favorite probably. So you're the system administrator for Fabricom. You have a main office, single DHCP server, single DHCP scope, and you need to configure it for high availability. So what you should do, what should you do, and then you choose all that apply. And these become pretty tough, but you need the failover cluster. You got to add the DHCP stuff to the failover cluster, deploy the new server, because you only have one right now. And then you want to add the DHCP role. So tough question, but these are the type of things that come up with the new item types. You know, it might not be in this format. It might be a drag and drop, where all these choices are listed on the left, and you got to drag them, and then you put them in the right order. So just be aware that you may see something like this. So let's talk Active Directory. We've got four big topics on AD. So the good news with Active Directory, everyone's probably adminned it and seen it and worked with it. And so some of this stuff is going to be pretty straightforward. Domain functional level and forest functional, you got to have all your DCs at whatever the functional level is that you're trying to go to. You know, if you're going to 2012, you got to have all your DCs on 2012. Pretty straightforward. You're likely to get some questions on those levels. It might be for a certain new role. It might be for something else, but you got to be familiar with that. Upgrading the forest functional levels, talked a little bit about that. So also know about the domain functional level for 2012. It basically has one feature kind of segmented into three sub-features. You want to be familiar with that because, you might get a scenario where, hey, you want the KDC support for claims. What should you do? Oh, you got to bump the level up. Or it might be, hey, you tried to set that in group policy. It doesn't work. Well, you might need to bump the level up. Multiple UPN suffixes. So when you're logging onto an environment, especially a big environment where you have multiple domains, multiple trusts, and you can log on to multiple domains, you know, making it simpler to log on like with an email address, like bsweetergall at domain.com instead of, the domain and the backslash stuff. That's where we're talking about UPNs. You want to know about adding more than one UPN in. You want to know about changing everyone's UPN. How would you bulk change everyone's UPN? Those are scenarios that could and may be covered on the exam, so be familiar with that stuff. All right, so let's talk trusts. The good news with trusts is pretty much nothing's changed with the basic trust types, right? You have your shortcut trust still, you got your external realm, forest, and domain trusts, which aren't listed up there for some reason. The key thing to study here, if you know your trust levels, is the authentication stuff. When you start thinking about maximizing security or the opposite, minimize administrative overhead, because if you go selective auth, that maximizes security, but it's a nightmare from an administration perspective. So you got to really be careful with the requirements. If it's, hey, we want to minimize administrative overhead, forest-wide authentication. And you want to be aware of those caveats because that is called out specifically in the OD. It's likely to be tested. Let's talk just briefly on the trust types, too. You want to know about all the trust types, right? So the shortcut trust, picture, a top-level forest and a bunch of domains, child domains underneath, and this one trusts this one, and the authentication goes all the way around. And the shortcut trust is kind of just to simplify it, make it faster. You want to know the details like I just described for all the different trusts. When you think about Realm, you should be thinking about Linux or Novell. If you're thinking about external trust, then you're thinking about, maybe you're thinking about NT4, and you're probably not going to see any of that. But just know all the trust types, too. All right, so sites, talking Active Directory sites. This, again, has been around a long time. Not a ton's changed here, so as long as you know what the basics of what a site is and what it's for, focus on the scenarios about logon times, authentication times being slow. A lot of you probably seen where it's like, hey, the network team added a bunch of wireless segments and they didn't tell you about it. Everyone on those segments is authenticating in Taiwan. We don't know what's going on. Be aware of those type of situations. Because for sites, because it's been around so long, it's been tested so many times, there's going to be scenarios like that to try to, breathe life into those type of questions. And then knowing the cost. You may get a diagram with, three or four sites, and it's 25 and 50, and this one's 75 and 10. You want to know when you add up the total cost of the links, the shortest path wins, the lowest cost wins. And then AD and sysvol replication. So password replication, thing to know here is you put up an RODC. Talk a little bit about that for a second. You put up an RODC, no one's password is cached. That's key. Got to configure that. And by default, all your admin accounts, all the people in the, what we'll call the restricted groups, domain admins, enterprise admins, that kind of thing, set to not cache, explicitly not cache on an RODC. So you want to know about those little things. You know, you put up an RODC, the admin goes log in for the first time, can't log in, WAN links down, what's going on? You know, you maybe want to avoid that. Know the rep admin command, because that's how you're going to view that stuff. And it may, a scenario may present itself. It's like, hey, how do we see what's going on? Rep admin. And you may not be thinking password and rep admin. You'd be thinking rep admin and replication. But with RODC, that is replication, all the passwords, right? Monitor manage replication is another topic. The Active Directory replication status tool. It's a newer tool. Most of the people I've been talking to haven't ever even seen or heard of the tool. So one thing I'd recommend, punch it into Bing or your favorite search engine and have a look at the tool, download it, it's free, and just take a look. It's a pretty good tool, and it's pretty new. I wouldn't be surprised if it was called out, since it's called out in the OD. And then finally, a scenario, upgrade sysvol replication to DFSR. This was more popular, I think it's a carryover from 2008 R2 for more than anything. Just be aware of the DFSR MIG, like migrate command. That's probably the biggest thing I'd say here. And then I think the domain functional level to 2008 or higher. If you know those two things, you're probably set on that area. So any questions on the last couple of slides before we move forward? I know it's a ton of content, and I kind of got to just fly through, but we do have a little time. All right, so we got an example question. You're the AD admin, Wingtip Toys, just acquired Tailspin Toys. Both companies have Active Directory. You need to ensure that the Wingtip Toys employees can access shared resources in the, I should say, the other environment. Which type of trust should you create? And this would be a very, very common scenario that you would find on the exam. It's going to be some scenario, you have this, you have that, and what kind of trust would you use? And you want to be able to call that out, especially the direction of the trust, right? Some people think, like, you know, you want to know trusting and trusted, you know, and does that, is trusted, is that outgoing, is that incoming? You want to be able to rattle that off the top of your head. There's definitely going to be some items on the trust types. This is just one I made up, though. All right, so now we're going to dive into identity and access. This is another one, like I said, about DAC earlier. This is another thing that a lot of people haven't touched. Everyone's touched AD to some extent. This is something a lot of people haven't touched. So if you're going to, you know, you're going to chunk out your study time, ADFS is one of the key areas that I'd focus on. All right, so just getting the terms down, that's probably the biggest thing. Knowing what a relying party trust is, knowing what a claim is, knowing what a claim description is. For a lot of people probably in the room, these are all brand new terms and you have no idea what they mean. The slide is probably a good thing to review before you walk in to take the exam, just knowing all this stuff. Knowing that the partner organization processes the claim. You know, you got one side's got the resources, one side's got the accounts, and you want to know what configurations you'd put in place on both sides. Which side needs ADFS? Both sides? What if both sides have ADFS? What about an ADFS proxy? These are all things that we'll dive into. I have another slide on it here. So the account partner organization, the resource partner organization, I kind of talked about that. One person has the resources, you know, one person's going to be the user side. So when we talk about ADFS, there's, you know, you got your ADFS servers, but you have your ADFS proxy. It's a key design consideration. So when you're thinking about like high security, maximize security, you're about to partner up with a supplier or something like that, you always want to be thinking proxy. Like scan right down to the answers and look for proxy and then read the rest of the question. That's kind of like a good idea. It uses HTTPS for the communication, and then I call out, you know, just a commandlet. Like I say, if you know the commandlet names, can kind of pick them out of a list, you're probably in pretty good shape. All right, so let's talk PKI, Active Directory Certificate Services. You got a certificate authority. That's one of the key areas that's being talked about. You have two different choices. You got enterprise and you have standalone. standalone and enterprise have very specific caveats about them. Enterprise, when you think enterprise, think about domain. Think about auto-enrollment, minimizing administration. Think about the distribution of the certificates. When you think about standalone, you know, what I think about is you're thinking about an offline route. You know, why wouldn't you want to deploy enterprise CA offline? Anybody know? And in the back? Well, it's actually more than that. So enterprise CA's got domain ties. If you take it offline and you wait long enough, you got a big problem on your hands. So these are little things just to review, because you really want to know about that stuff. I think auto enrollment for the enterprise is key. Knowing that when you have the domain-based stuff and the auto enrollment and the enterprise, that you have automatic trust of the root. You know, you might see a scenario where you need to deploy the root CA certificate to all your clients. Well, maybe you don't want to do that. You want to minimize administration. You want to go back to enterprise CA. The standalone, no ADDS, so that's kind of key. You may have a DMZ environment, and they call it out as no ADDS, but you need PKI. What kind of CA should you deploy? That's your answer. One thing to know, templates can't be used, and then all certificate requests by default set to pending until approved by an admin. So that's high administration. Okay, so a couple other things about ADCS. You got the online responder. So, you know, generally speaking, when you go and you validate, a client computer validates a certificate, is it expired, was it revoked, that kind of thing. You used a list, a web server, something like that. Now we have online responder. Look for scenarios where you're looking to minimize or speed up or make it more efficient. It's always going to be online responder. It's also more up to date. So if something happened an hour ago, CRL may not be your best bet. It's going to be online responder. You know, how do you prevent this from happening in the future? Get to an online responder. It's going to be something like that. And then the backup recovery, the cert util, got to know that. Just the cert util part is probably enough, but just be aware of this stuff. And if you've got ADCS up in your environment, run it one time. Just do, back up the key, back up the database. And now let's talk about the certificates themselves. So we talked earlier, certificate templates got to be enterprise CA. You can add a template via PowerShell. The auto-enrollment's probably, on this particular slide, the number one thing. You got to know how it works, where do you go configure it, what are the requirements. I call out what I consider to be the most important stuff. And you can update certificates that use the certificate template. You can renew expired certificates. And then the GPO area. You might get that called out. You know, some of the hot area items, if you guys haven't seen them, you know, they'll call out the actual group policy management console, and it'll be like 10, 12 choices, and it'll say, select the area where you would go. And so just being able to call out the path, you don't need to know everything, but just like being able to call that out, ADCS, PKI, you know, public key, that kind of thing. And then at the bottom, key recovery. You got to configure the certificate template for key archival, and then you've got to enroll users based on the new template. So what a scenario for this particular thing is that, you know, you've got a certificate template. It doesn't have key archival. It's been distributed. You select it for key archival, and then somebody loses their key. You want to do a key archival recovery. It's not there. They're not part of the new template. They never re-enrolled, you know, that kind of thing. So you want to know the order of how things have to happen. All right, so let's talk ADRMS. This is another one, kind of like ADFS. A lot of people haven't touched it. Let me get a show of hands. Who has run ADRMS in a production environment? Oh, we got a few people, probably three or four people. You will be tested on ADRMS on the exam. What the questions are, I can't tell you, right? But it's called out, and you know, here we are. So specifically for 412, install licensing or certificate ADRMS server. You want to know the difference between a licensing-only server and a non-licensing-only server, what they call ADRMS server. Licensing-only, I call out a couple things, specific department policies or templates. Let me briefly talk ADRMS. So what it does, allows you to use Office products to encrypt and make sure so-and-so can only print, read, or not do anything with it. Email, do not forward, that kind of thing. So you configure templates for that, right? And the templates are available in Word and Outlook and all that kind of stuff. Problem is, and this is key to the exam, you configure one set of templates and they're available to everybody. And so if you want to do templates for accounting and they have special templates that only they're going to use, and template, you need another licensing server. So that's something to know. The SCP, the service connection point, the one caveat I call out here requires enterprise admin. You know, you might see domain admin. Almost everything you can do with domain admin, this requires enterprise admin. That's something to know. And then the other thing, the client deployment, the main thing here, Vista and later, the ADRMS client's actually built in. So you don't have to really do anything with it. With XP, though, it's not built in. You got to distribute it. You got to have a method for that. There's also some template distribution concerns there. I don't anticipate XP. You know, it's kind of coming to the end of life, but it might be in there. And then let's talk managed trusted domains, trusted user domains. This is so if you have one caveat. ADRMS, use internal only. Like everything we've been talking about, it's internal only. If I send an email to Clifton here and it's ADRMS, he can't do anything with it. That's when we get into the trusted user domain. So, you know, you can process requests. We also talk, I think, in the next slide about federation. So you can do ADRMS between orgs. But know that otherwise it's all internal. Publishing domains, process license requests for content, trusted user domain, trusted publishing domain, kind of one and together. The federated identity support, this is a key one, because it's going to be, hey, what do I need? I want to do ADRMS between two different orgs. What should you do first? And it's like, ADFS. You can do it without ADFS. You want to know how these technologies tie together, what to use. I talked a little bit about this earlier. Template distribution is automatic for Vista and later. You get that XP caveat. You can do it via GPO, script, central location, something like that. And then there's also something called exclusion policy. So for ADRMS, you can say, hey, look, you can't use ADRMS unless PowerPoint's version 14 or higher, or your ADRMS client is a certain version. Long time ago, there was a security incident with the ADRMS client, and this would have been a played a key role at the time. And then the users, if you want somebody to configure them so they can't use ADRMS, you can actually exclude them. You want to know about that kind of stuff, because maybe you want to deploy ADRMS for the whole environment but not the accounting department. What do? You exclude them. Those are some, like the scenarios you might run into. Questions on ADRMS? Anything? All right, so let's talk about the related content. I know we flew through that pretty quick. We can talk some question and answer session. We probably have a few more minutes. There's a couple of breakout sessions, a couple of hands-on labs. We talked dynamic access control. If you have time, it would definitely be worth going to see that, because that one's one that, you know, like setting it up in your home lab or your work lab, it's quite a bit of effort and work. And what I picture people doing is trying to go through that and going, oh man, forget it, I'll just hack through it. And maybe that'll be the two questions you miss and you fail the exam. So if you get to that. And then the 412, 417, 411, 410, all that stuff's related. I'm going to be around at the info desk and at the study hall tomorrow, the next day. If you guys want to chat more about the exams or my experiences or anything like that, stop by. We'll go through it. We have some resources for you guys. You've probably seen this in every session. You know, it's mandatory into slide type of stuff. So have a look at these. There is some pretty good stuff. The Channel 9 stuff has gotten a lot better. Really good use there. And then finally, complete the evaluation. Win the Xbox. I said earlier, no Xbox One, but it's a 360. Maybe you win. So if you get a chance, do that. And then we're done with the content. But if you guys want to hang out and chat for a couple of minutes about some of the topics, the slides, you got something you want to do privately up here, we can do that afterwards. Otherwise, thanks, guys.